Another 50 for the U.S. to act like a democracy again. Any budget resolution will be temporary and will go through another shakedown before Christmas while millions lose health care and benefits, tens of thousands lose paychecks. Help your neighbors, support local businesses and officials. Trump can be Trump. We don't need to go back, we need to evolve. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 1st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Anna Wilcox, Dave Johnson, Althea Billings, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodewell. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, and Farah Siddiqui. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Cheryl Denise. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez to talk about her latest story for the paper. It's called Dreaming of Survival, Self-Governed Homeless Shelter Right to Dream 2 Facing Financial Crisis. Welcome to the show, Kanani.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here with us. So this piece dives into one of the city's first micro-village shelters, Right to Dream 2. It's coming up on its 14-year anniversary pretty soon. So how did this micro-village get its start?
Like you mentioned, Right to Dream 2 started in 2011, and it was initially a protest against the city's sidewalk management ordinance. And in response to that, there were a group of people who were living on the streets that started an encampment in Old Town, Chinatown, right next to where the Chinatown gates are. And since then, the encampment has been moved and now sits near the Moda Center. But I think in its history, one of the pieces that some of the co-founders really expressed was that this very much was the conviction of people who are living on the streets that really wanted to see change and an opportunity to create a community that was self-governed and where they could contribute to their own shelter circumstances, which is different than what we see in a larger congregate shelter that is more beholden to the bureaucratic process of maybe the city or the county.
Well, right, like you mentioned, Right to Dream 2 is a self-governed shelter. What does that mean in practice?
Yeah, how they described it was kind of a double democratic process. So you have the folks who living there, the residents, are also the people who are responsible for establishing the rules of the village and also the rules enforcement. So if someone in the community breaks one of those rules, there's an opportunity for the folks living there to come together and talk about what that means. And one of the things they emphasize is it being a low barrier shelter. So oftentimes folks who maybe have been turned away from other shelter models can find an opportunity to stay at Right to Dream 2. And they're also their board of directors are folks who are managing the fundraising and kind of the financial aspect of the of the village and some of their board members as well are folks that have lived at Right to Dream 2. And so I think the emphasis is that the folks that are living there are really also managing the community and, you know, keeping it running and making sure that people are getting the things they need and advocating for those things within the community.
It's interesting as well that they have permanent tiny homes for members of the community, but also sort of a drop-in situation for people to come just for a night or two. How does this model of shelter compare to other ones that the city and county maintain?
Yeah, so I think that some of the more popular or well-known shelters that folks will know is a congregate shelter model, which is oftentimes many, many people in one room. Sometimes, you know, all these shared beds, shared bathrooms and things like that. And so the emphasis on the village model, and in this case, they describe themselves as a micro village, is individuals kind of having that privacy and also being just serving a smaller amount of people, and where there's opportunities there to have more tailored and direct care to people's needs. Whereas possibly in a larger shelter space, when you have many, many people, not being able to concentrate, you know, kind of getting needs specific with the folks that are staying there. But the city does now have the Safe Rest Villages, which are a similar model, but not the same. They're not self-governed, and some of them being managed by Urban Alchemy and having an outside kind of resource and security and things like that, where, you know, we have heard complaints from current residents of those Urban Alchemy Ranch shelters about the security and just about the community and safety there. Whereas I think what Right to Dream 2 talks about is how the self-governing model gives people the agency and this feeling of comfort and safety in the spaces that they're cultivating. So there are similar models, you know, in the city, but I think what the big difference here is the self-governed aspect.
So in your article, you reference a report called the Micro Village Expansion Project, which came out in 2024. Talk to me about that one. What were some of its findings?
Yes, so Michael Moore, who I spoke with from Right to Dream 2, so one of the co-founders and a current board member, worked on a project called the Micro Village Expansion Project. And it was a collective of folks who had lived in micro villages and the village shelter type models, and other folks who would consider themselves allies of that community. And they all did contributed to a report asking folks who have lived in this type of shelter, you know, what they took away from it, what are the pros and cons, and how this could be replicated. So the report kind of serves as something, you know, a city or a county entity could use to ask themselves, should we create a micro village model, or anyone, I guess, who is interested in doing something like that. So the report has a lot of information and resources about what these folks who have lived in these shelters have gleaned from their time there, and offers suggestions of, you know, the size of these shelters and how many people they felt you could effectively serve, and things like that. And so I think it is a really good chance for someone who is interested in this model to learn about its successes and what works and what doesn't. And so I think a lot of that mission is just getting that information out there and knowing that micro villages are a resource for folks who are looking to address the homelessness crisis in the city or county or virtually anywhere.
There's a report from PSU that talks about the differing costs between different types of shelter. So how does that shake out for something like a self-governed micro-village and a congregate shelter?
Yeah, so there was another report I looked at, which is came out of PSU. And what that showed, I think, for example, Right to Dream 2 takes right now currently says that they need about $5,000 to $6,000 to operate monthly. And the cost of running a congregate shelter is lower. And one of the things that the report emphasizes is that, you know, there is a danger of comparing these numbers, right? If one is cheaper, therefore it is a better model to run, right? And so one of the things that the report discusses is that really what we could be looking at when comparing is which of these models is successfully helping people exit out of homelessness and into perhaps transitional housing or permanent housing. And so although the village model is more costly and is serving maybe at a time a smaller amount of people than a congregate shelter, the report does show that the village models had a higher success rate for getting people into transitional and permanent housing, whereas the congregate shelters were as less successful. But I think one thing to be clear about as well is that in that report through PSU, Right to Dream 2 was not one of the village models that was analyzed for that report, but they did compare congregate shelters, motel turned shelters, RV park shelters, and the other village models that the city has. But because Right to Dream 2 is not a city model, it was not one of the ones analyzed in that report.
Right to Dream 2 is facing a financial crisis. What's going on for them?
Yeah, so I had a chance to chat with some board members and residents and folks at Right to Dream 2. And as I mentioned, they, you know, talked about the $5,000 to $6,000 a month it costs to operate the site, which they said, you know, comparable to some of the other costs of, you know, running operations like this it feels fairly low. And so they were talking about how they have really, really succeeded in years past with the support of individuals just in the community who are committing to $5 or $10 a month. And one of the things that the organizers were really asking for is for more folks who are able to commit to a monthly recurring donation. And one of the struggles that it seems that they're having is finding a sustainable income, where there have been opportunities in the past for grant funding from maybe the city or the county, but because of Right to Dream 2's model, they described it as trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, where, you know, the homeless services department, formerly the Joint Office, has grant opportunities for models like this. There are specifications that they said that they do not fit in. And so I think some of that is because of their self-governed model, right? And so they, I think, are in a hard place where they want to honor this this model that they have that has been working for years and has been successful. And so I think part of maintaining that has been that they're not always eligible for these grant funding opportunities. And so they're really just hoping to encourage their community members and those that wish to support to sign up to donate.
Right to Dream 2 is located in Portland's District 2. You reached out to the counselors from the area. What was their response?
Yeah, so as you said, they're in District 2, so they're represented by Elena Pertle-Guinney, Samir Kanal, and Dan Ryan. And one of the things that Right to Dreams you mentioned is that the city could really help sustain their operation if they were to able to take over the cost of their garbage or their porta potties or toilet situation. And so I wasn't able to chat directly with all of the counselors, and some had just sent over a statement. And it seems that both Kanal and Pertle-Guinney are supportive of the, you know, the micro-village and self-governed model, and spoke about the value they see in that as well. And so, but they were not exactly able to speak to whether or not they think the city could cover some of those costs. And so I think that's something that we'll have to look out for. And Dan Ryan had also given us a statement about his support for the Safe Rest Villages, but Right to Dream 2 is not a safe rest village. So I believe that maybe he is supportive of the village model. I'm, you know, making an assumption there. But he said that he is a champion of the safe rest villages, but did not exactly comment on Right to Dream 2 specifically. So I think there's an opportunity there for some follow-up.
Well, I understand that Right to Dream 2's anniversary celebration is coming up. Could you tell me about that?
Yes. So the organizers mentioned they'll be celebrating their 14th anniversary on Sunday, October 12th, from 1 to 4 at the village's site, which is at North Thunderbird Way. And they just said that this will be an opportunity for anyone in the community who's interested in learning about the organization to come out and join them for a barbecue. They'll be giving tours of the site and also have some folks who were part of the founding of the village site there as well to talk about its history and just really encourage anyone in the community who's interested to come out and join them for the barbecue.
What do you want folks to take away from this story?
I think that I learned a lot reporting on this story about, you know, the different models that the city and county and individuals, in this case, independent people, are offering to addressing homelessness. And I think there are many conversations happening all the time about what is the right way and what feels like is a waste of taxpayer money or, you know, conflict, right? And that not everyone can agree on one thing, and that's totally fine. That's life. But I do think that I would hope someone could take away from this story that there are models that do work and they aren't always what you expect. And also that these reports are really valuable pieces of information. And so for folks who have time and interest to read them, I think really looking at the numbers and successes of the different models that are being offered to address homelessness are all worth looking into.
If our listeners are interested, where can they learn more?
You can read this story at streetroots.org or any of our social media platforms at StreetRoots. And if you're interested in supporting Right to Dream 2, they do have their fundraiser currently up on their website.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think that one of the things that we had a chance to do when I reported on this story was talk to folks who have, you know, lived there and talked about how Right to Dream 2 has been really the last stop or last opportunity when they had nowhere else to stay, and really emphasized the value of being a resident there and contributing to that community. So I think that, yeah, having a chance to talk to people who really benefit from the organization's work and also work to keep it going is really valuable and something worth learning about.
Well, Kanani, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
That was Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez speaking with me about her latest story for the paper. It's called Dreaming of Survival, Self-Governed Homeless Shelter, Right to Dream 2 Facing Financial Crisis. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield will be in federal court Friday arguing for a temporary injunction to stop President Trump from federalizing the Oregon National Guard. He spoke with KBOO's Anna Wilcox about the case and the work of the Oregon Department of Justice.
President Trump federalized the National Guard through Title 10 code orders. Can you briefly explain what this means and what this order is typically used for?
So the president used a law that allows him to federalize the National Guard, and effectively what he's trying to do is put those troops on the streets here in Portland. And I think if you think about common sense and the way that you normally just interact in America or in Oregon, we all know that that's not normal to see the United States military on the streets of our cities. And the reason it's not normal is you have various laws that, again, prevent the president from federalizing the National Guard, except under really extreme circumstances. And so in this case, you have three circumstances, and you have to meet either one of those or any one of those. And one of them is, you know, is this an invasion, by a foreign entity? And obviously, and we can say that that's not an invasion going on. There's not a rebellion going on. The president can still execute the laws of the United States. And so those are the three conditions which you would federalize or can federalize the National Guard. And obviously none of those are going on in Oregon right now.
You fired a temporary injunction to block the federalization of the Guard within 6 hours of receiving notice of deployment. What's the function of doing this, and what do you hope this accomplishes?
And when you file a temporary restraining order, effectively that is a motion that you do real early on in the case, and it's before you really get to the merits of the case. And it's incredibly high burden to actually get a judge to approve a temporary restraining order. And effectively what that would do early on in a case is pause the status quo. So, for instance, in this case, it wouldn't allow President Trump to federalize the National Guard. It would pause everything so that way the court could consider the full merits of the case. That's why it's this immediate action. That's why they call it a temporary restraining order, to kind of really get in the court. But it allows you to get in front of a judge, talk about facts, and actually get a ruling very quickly to prevent harm in the community, or in any case that you're seeking a temporary restraining order.
Federal military intervention has been attempted in other U.S. cities in recent months, and there have been lawsuits to attempt to stop those, right? So is there anything unique about Oregon in comparison to D.C., L.A., and Chicago?
And so what you're seeing right now is the normalization of the United States military on the streets of our cities. So you saw it in California, you saw it in Washington, D.C., it's talked about in Memphis, it's talked about in Illinois, and the orders have been executed here in Oregon. Each one of those situations is a little bit different, and the facts vary in the different states. The one thing that I would tell you here in Oregon, which is incredibly clear, is our facts are probably the clearest case of where the president should not have the ability to federalize the National Guard. Again, using those three different categories, whether there's a rebellion, an invasion, or whether the president can't execute the laws of the United States, it's really clear in Oregon that none of those conditions exist. And it's even more clear than it was in any of the other places. Washington, D.C. is a little bit more of a different animal than, say, a state. And so that's kind of a little bit of a different analysis, but really kind of the closest thing would be California. But again, the facts are vastly different on the ground between those two states. What you really have is you have the president who has formulated opinion about what's going on in Portland. And his opinion has been based upon, you know, social media gossip, things that he's heard, and has been unwilling to listen or talk to people on the ground to actually understand what the circumstances are in Oregon, which is probably the big issue here in the dispute. Either that or it's incredibly politically motivated. And I think a lot of people, myself included, feel that way in terms of the, what I would say, the recklessness of ignoring the facts on the ground. And then this attempt, again, as you're seeing it nationwide, even yesterday was probably one of the most disturbing things that you could hear in the United States, where the president talked about using American cities as training grounds for the United States military. It's a wild time. Those things are un-American. That's the type of thing you expect to see in a third world country, not in an American city.
Where does the process go from here? So what can we expect from the hearing on Friday? Or do you have any hopes for that hearing?
Yeah, so the first step is we'll get a hearing in front of the judge, which is on 10 a.m. Friday. And we'll go through that process. And the hope is to have a ruling on that motion as soon as possible. Now, obviously, you can't predict how fast the judge or the court system is going to move. But we do anticipate that likely to happen, as soon as that day or probably within 48 hours. Now, could it be longer? Absolutely. It's really going to depend on some of the circumstances that present in the courtroom. Our goal, and our goal has been from the very beginning, that as soon as the president issued formal orders, we wanted to be in court in less than 12 hours, and we wanted to have a motion filed to get in front of a judge as soon as possible. So we've been pushing this thing along as quickly as we can, because we believe that if we're able to pause the president's action, we believe that that is better for maintaining public safety in Portland on the whole.
I really hear you when you say that we're really not used to seeing troops on the ground in the United States. It's not something that we're accustomed to, and not something that I think I've ever seen in my lifetime. What should the average Oregonian do about this then? If we do have the National Guard on the streets here in Portland, what should the average Oregonian do? How should we interact? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and normally when you have the National Guard in community, right, it's for a natural disaster. It's for things where the governor might say, hey, boy, we need a little extra help, with the wildfire, with flooding. There's a lot of other circumstances where you might see that, and it's pretty normal, right? It fits their skill set. Public safety, while these folks are amazing and incredibly trained human beings, you have law enforcement like the Portland Police, the Sheriff's Department, that are really trained in this type of activity. So unique situation, and I think for us in Oregon is to remember is that Oregon National Guard members are Oregonians at the core. And so knowing that they are fulfilling their mission and their obligation when they take a dual oath with the federal government and the state, I think we should all really appreciate that they are caught in the middle of what is a president that is pushing the bounds of, our democracy at this point in time. And I think our job at the Oregon Department of Justice is to push back, draw a real clear line in the sand and say, this is unlawful what you're trying to do, and uphold there. And then I think we as Oregonians have a right to sit there and peacefully talk about why this is not the America or the future that we want to have in this state. And so I think that's kind of how we have to look at all these different elements as we're moving forward, but always remembering that Oregon, the folks that serve in our Oregon National Guard are Oregonians.
You have a number of active lawsuits against the Trump administration. It seems like there's a lot to be done to protect Oregonians. So on a personal level, how do you keep up with it, or how do you keep at it every day?
I think when I ran for attorney general, there was a lot of things that really excited me. There were a lot of things that I was just couldn't wait to start working on. At the time, if you had told me I would have filed more than 40 lawsuits, by September of the first year in office, I would have told you had lost your mind. What I would have, would never have believed that even in the, in almost all of the cases where we've sought immediate relief, courts have been granting that relief. So it's a really unique set of circumstances and time that we're living in. It's incredibly meaningful to do that work. I think we're right now in all those lawsuits protecting more than $4.4 billion of funding into this state. We've got a handful of cases that are protecting the central rights that all Americans, doesn't matter what party affiliation you believe in, we really have ingrained in us as American citizens. And at the same time, all of this work is going on, I think the shame of all of that is it distracts away from all of the other amazing work that's going on at the Oregon Department of Justice. Just yesterday, and one thing I'm incredibly proud about, is on one day, we can be sitting there defending Oregon and pushing back against the president on the National Guard. The very next day, we hosted a roundtable talking about our expanded work in consumer protection, where we're doubling the size of the work that we're doing on behalf of working families. We announced the Working Families Unit. Some of the work that we're doing on public safety, that has yet to really come into the light, because truly the federal stuff, because it is so immediate, is so in front of us, that naturally takes up a lot of the media. But we're doing a lot of other, what I would say, incredibly important work in the public safety arena, as well as protecting our consumers, our seniors, working families, and kids. So that's very exciting and meaningful things to do. I think for me, if I was only doing one thing and it was the federal work, I would really feel like we weren't serving all of Oregonians, because there's so much more amazing work that gets done at the Oregon Department of Justice.
With everything that's going on, there's a lot of confusion and a lot of, I think, concern about the time we're in at the moment and what we can do to stay safe and stay together. Is there like a final thing that you wish that Oregonians would hear as they're trying to like understand this particular moment in time?
The one thing that I keep thinking to myself is that, I don't think that we as a society should wind up being the frog in boiling water. I think we have to put everything into context and look at everything that we're seeing and pushing back against that. It started with the president attacking our independent judiciary. That's a hallmark of any democracy, having an independent judiciary that's not going to be pushed around by a president, that isn't going to be pushed around by Congress. You now have politicians openly talking about gerrymandering and rigging our elections to maintain power in Congress. Talk about one of the most un-American things that you could blatantly just be so bold to talk about. You have a president that is leading through fear and not bringing together, where his own party can't say how they really feel because they're so fearful of retaliation. And then you have this normalization of military in our cities. This isn't the America that we want to live in. This isn't the America that we grew up in. It's a very different time, and I think we need to recognize all of the different elements that are kind of coming together and saying, this isn't what we want. But then at the same time that we as citizens sit there and say, this is not the state or the country that we want to be in, we then have to start talking about what we do want it to be like. Because I don't think as a society we can always run against things or talk about things that we're not for. We have to actually show people what this state and what this country can be. And that, to me, is a positive part, right? If you're only talking about the negative stuff, it becomes really dark. But I think we have to be walking and moving towards something that we all have shared values, and to remember that no matter what your party affiliation is, I've never met a Republican or a Democrat who